Columbia presents Corwin. Tonight, Norman Corwin brings you Cromer, the story of a small town in a big war. This program, number one of a trilogy dealing with cities and towns, was first produced shortly after Corwin made a trip to Britain for CBS in the summer of 1942. And tonight, as 2 years ago, Joseph Julian narrates. The musical score is composed and conducted by Lynn Murray. Norman Corwin's Cromer. A town is like a person. It has a character, a complexion, and a name. It has a set of habits. It's hardworking or lazy, rich or poor, handsome or ugly. Some towns never amount to much. Some get sick and die. Some grow big and powerful and lead their race. But all towns, be they so great they call themselves metropolises, or so small you'd miss them if you winked while driving through. All towns have this in common. They are mortal. They know seasons and the way of winds, each taking its share of sun and moon and standing up to storm. And they are mortal also in the respect of violence and death, for war may come to any and to all of them. Troy was a town. So was Jericho. Lidice was a town. Likewise, Our Lady, the Queen of the Angels of Porciuncula, later to be known as Los Angeles. And Cromer was a town, and is a town, and you'll find it on a map of the east coast of England, in the ancient division of the country called East Anglia, facing the North Sea, facing Germany.
I set out by train for Cromer one sunny September morning, leaving from a station in the east end of London. Incidentally, you spell it with a C, not a K. C-R-O-M-E-R, Cromer. The things you notice on a train ride in a frontline country are no different from what you notice on a train ride anywhere. Small talk overheard, the beard on the man sitting opposite, pattern of the holes punched in your ticket by the conductor.
Change at Cambridge for Cromer.
Yes, I know, thank you. Little differences in railway manners, such as etchings on the walls of the compartments, and the fact that when the steward comes through to announce lunch, he doesn't yell, "First call for lunch," but says,
"Those requiring lunch will please go forward to the dining coach."
A lot of unimportant things stick in your mind. In the smoker, for example, I overheard two officers, a Canadian and an Englishman, talking very earnestly. Do you suppose they were discussing the war? Or the Commonwealth of Nations? Or sports? Women? Horses? Books? Not at all. They were saying,
"But what does Coca-Cola taste like, Coca?"
"Well, no. It's sort of hard to describe."
"Does it taste like ginger?"
"It's more like molasses." No, that's not right either.
What's the other drink like?"
"The other?"
"Hmm.
Well, I don't really know how to describe that either."
"Does it have a peppermint taste to it?"
"No, no. It's about the same, almost, I think."
Things like that you notice. They make up a journey. Also, towns and cities and fields freshly plowed, aircraft overhead. And of course you notice the weather, which changes every 15 minutes like morning radio programs. When I got to Cromer, it was raining. I checked in at the police station, which is considered good form for all visitors. Otherwise, you're liable to be pinched.
"May I see your passport?"
Handed the officer the original passport, which the State Department of the United States of America gave me as a farewell present when I left for England. He fanned through it, studying all the visas and rubber stampings.
"Now, if I may see your national identity card, that's all I'll trouble you for."
"No trouble at all. Nothing like making sure, is there?" If you lived 45 minutes flying time from a Nazi airdrome, you'd want to make sure who was poking his nose into your business, too.
These are all right. Where are you staying in Cromer?
Oh, I've got a reservation at the Red Lion Hotel.
I see. Well, thank you very much. Hope you have a pleasant stay.
Thank you. Good day. Which it wasn't, believe me. It was a miserable day. I plodded through the murk to the hotel, hardly noticing the town and the bomb damage as I went. And when I reached the Red Lion, which was standing proud and wet on Cromer's East Cliff, I found that its name was not the Red Lion, but Ye Olde Red Lion. And this was a disappointment, because somehow I never expected to meet up with Ye Olde Spelling Ye in England. I thought the only place you found that stuff was in the tea shoppies, the fancy hamburger joints on the state highways in New Jersey. Well, anyway, after I registered, I went upstairs, hoping to kick my shoes off in a warm room overlooking the North Sea. The chief maid of the Red Lion preceded me.
Here is your room, sir. Bathroom's down the hall.
It wasn't a warm room, it was a cold room. It didn't overlook the North Sea, it overlooked a brick wall. Have you no rooms facing the sea?
No, sir, we've closed all the front rooms.
Closed them?
Yes, sir, shut tight.
What's the matter, ghosts?
No, sir, on account of the blackout.
How do you mean, on account of the blackout?
Well, as there's no way of checking from the waterfront to make sure there's no light coming from windows facing the sea, we're not allowed to rent rooms facing the water.
Mm-hmm. I hadn't thought of that.
Yes, sir. Well, good day.
You know how it is. You get in a place and right away you want to see what it looks like. I put on a raincoat and went out of the Red Lion into the gray day. The narrow streets were almost deserted. The buildings of the town seemed huddled together for warmth. The Hotel de Paris dripped sadly, as though grieving for the city whose name it bore. On High Street, few shoppers went in and out of Rust's department store. The pubs were closed until 4. I climbed Lighthouse Hill and sat on a rock looking down on Cromer and the sea. There it was, the unimportant town of Cromer, Norfolk County. A sleepy place with a mist on her. There was the church, the pier, the beach, the town, all in one tight little landscape. The church, the kind architects call perpendicular, had been bombed, but it was still perpendicular. And I thought, as the gentle rain from heaven dripped down my neck, what could the Axis possibly want with a harmless shore town on the North Sea? Obviously, the same things they wanted and managed to get in certain shore towns strung out along the Baltic, the Mediterranean, the Black Sea, the China Sea. They want your money and your life, that's all. Just want to own you and your country. What they got in shore spots like Trondheim and Manila, they'd like to get in Cromer and points west. Well, by this time, I was cold and wet enough to leave Lighthouse Hill, which I did, in search of a pub. First one I came to had a sign over the door.
Courage, fully licensed.
Name of an ale manufacturer who owns a chain of pubs. Maybe their ale gives you courage. I couldn't say. I happen to be drinking milder stuff.
What's yours, please?
Mild and bitter.
Mild and bitter? Right.
I leaned on the counter. Pretty soon a man came in, middle-aged, looked like a businessman. He ordered ale, stood alongside for a bit, and then, marking me for a stranger, he started a conversation. It was a very simple way to do that, and it's based on the universal taste for tobacco.
I say, would you like a cigarette?
Oh, thank you very much. We fell to talking, and it turned out he was a native of Cromer. He was proud of the town.
Ah, you should have seen this town in summer, before the war. Wasn't a season went by we didn't handle 75,000 people here, including transients.
That's so.
Oh, yes, yes. Our 8 biggest hotels used to be jam-packed from June to September.
The autumn rain kept beating down on the roof as he talked. Made it hard to imagine Cromer ever having been a busy and sunlit town. But he revived it, gave it life, lighting up that dim pub with his account of concerts on the pier and the pavilion crowded with funmakers, and the putting greens and the bowling lawns doing business far into the night.
Excellent bathing here, too. You know, one of the best things about Cromer is the fact that there's no objection to sunbathing. Provided it's done decently, of course.
Any fishing and boating?
Oh, yes, good catches of whiting and flatfish. You see, we're not far from the Norfolk Broads.
Who are they?
Who?
What about the weather here? I threw him on the defensive. I didn't mean the question that way.
We're actually the driest part of England. You know, as a matter of fact, the late Empress of Austria used to come here for her health.
You mean the late Empress of the late Austria?
Yes, rather, yes.
Fill them up again, gentlemen.
Yes, please.
Here, let me.
No, this is mine.
Oh, well, thank you very much. For another round, this went on. The story of Happy Cromer before the rise of the fascists. And then I asked him what the war had done to the town, and he told me. He told me 100 little stories of how life had changed here. How some of the men of Cromer had gone away to fight and had been killed. Some had stayed at home and been killed. How the town's fishing and crabbing industry had been ruined. 7 of its 8 hotels shut down. How the people stood up through the bombings. How they organized to take on their share of the war. Then he lowered a glass of ale and said to me,
It's been a big job for a little town. We took our beating just like London and Coventry and Swansea and all the rest. And I think we've done pretty well, considering.
He looked at his watch and decided it was time to leave. I left with him. The proprietor waved a friendly dish rag at us.
Well, good night, gentlemen. God bless.
Good night, Tom.
Good night. For a couple of minutes, in the gathering dusk, we walked without speaking. Cromer was still after the rain. Only the sound of dripping eaves. Far off bus starting up in low gear. What's that, a Wellington?
Let me see. No, that's a bullfighter.
Not making any local stops, is he?
A very fast ship, bullfighter.
You get many alerts here?
Well, we've had our share. Sometimes the Jerrys come in low to avoid detection and drop bombs before we have a chance to sound an alert.
Must make you feel nice and secure.
Don't worry. We do the same to them.
I hope so.
Incidentally, did you know that Cromer's the nearest point in the British Isles to Germany?
Is that a fact?
Yeah.
My geography must be all screwy. As a matter of fact, I thought Hey, this place got a whack, didn't it?
Yes. Whole family wiped out here last July.
What a mess.
Man and his wife, her mother and father, 2 children, all killed.
Gosh. I'd seen acres and acres of bomb damage in London. But they were all tidied up like the ruins of Pompeii by the time I got there. This was my first close-up of a house, just as it had been left by a high-explosive bomb.
Would you like to walk on the ruins?
Well, if it's all right to do so, I...
Certainly. Come on.
It was a weird sensation. Walking over this debris in which a family had been murdered. There was a torn black slipper, woman's leg of a table, picture frame, pie-shaped fragment of crockery plate, head of a doll. Granny and Gramp and Mom and Pop and the kids. Dead. Done in by the fascists. The war of the Luftwaffe against the scullery table and the chest of drawers and the clean sheets in the linen closet. Little Pamela, who played with a doll, wants to be remembered as Fritz Tyson, the industrialist who backed Hitler because he wanted to keep the people down. She says, "Good evening, Mr. Tyson. How are things in Switzerland?" Mom's big serving dish, which she bought at the fair in Norwich, was smashed in several pieces. Now, Mom is wondering whether the magazine publisher, who thinks a little fascism might be good for America, would care to repair the dish. Kitchen clock, a china toilet bowl, the middle plank of the dining room table. Send their respects to Rudolf Hess and ask after his health. And Pop, being the head of the family, like to write an inscription in that book written by Lord Londonderry, the one that admires Der Fuhrer. Mom and Pop and the old folks and the kids were sleeping on the premises when it happened. They're sleeping not far from here right now. That's how to keep the people down, all right, Tyson. They're down. All the way. Good and down. Won't hear from them again. It was dark. A few stars were showing through broken clouds. Weather was clearing. Said goodbye to my friend and went back to the hotel for dinner. The maid of the Red Lion, the same one who showed me to my room, also waited on table. Every time she served anything, she said, "Thank you." I was intrigued by the effect when she distributed rolls to a group of six men sitting at a table.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
She thanked her way through a three-course meal, which left me still hungry. And afterward, I went down to the lounge and struck up a conversation with a pleasant, white-haired, white-mustached man who turned out to be chairman of the Urban District Council. A sort of board of selectmen. He was H.A. Mitchell, Justice of the Peace. I asked him about the town government, and he told me how it was set up.
As for me, I'm a member of the Labor Party.
Is this a Labor town?
Oh, no, conservative. In fact, a Tory stronghold.
Well, how is it you were elected?
Nobody can quite figure that out.
Maybe just because they like you.
Well, they didn't always like me. I remember the time when a Cromer crowd knocked me down and set my hat on fire.
Why did they do that?
They were so bitter about my representing labor.
Good heavens.
But I've been elected twice since then, so you could say we're progressing, couldn't you?
Sure could.
After they'd burnt my hat, I used to bring it around every election and display it under a sign which said, Tory argument.
Well, personally, I think the Tories have burnt all their hats behind them.
I don't know. They've learned some manners. Why, there was a man tried seven times to get on the council here, and he was defeated each time. Finally, he was invited to become a member.
I asked Mitchell whether the town figured in any special war activity.
Well, I was asked by the United Nations to hold a little service here on United Nations Day.
And did you?
Oh, yes.
I could just see the United Nations asking the chairman of the Cromer Council to hold a service. There'd be a round-robin letter signed by the leaders of 30 nations. In the White House in Washington, Steve Early would remind the president...
Frank, don't forget to send a message to H.I. Mitchell about that service in Cromer.
While in the Kremlin, Joe Stalin would sign a note...
Vas privietstuviem, tovarich, Mitchell.
And Churchill would ask his secretary...
Get Mitchell on the phone... And tell him there's a pile of petitions from our allies waiting for him here.
And why not? Isn't Cromer on the side of the United Nations? Belonging to them? Its future tied up with theirs? Its men fallen for the same good reason? All honor to Mitchell for saying it the way he did. Well, the gathering in the lounge broke up and I went along to bed. As I undressed, I heard a plane coming over. I remembered we were 45 minutes from a Nazi airdrome, and sometimes the Hun dropped bombs before an alert could be sounded. But having been 3 months in England, this troubled me the way it must have worried H.A. Mitchell. And I slept like a rock on the Norfolk coast. Cromer was a different place in the morning. It sparkled under a clear blue sky. There was just a nip of a north wind. I went down to breakfast, made an omelet of powdered eggs, which tasted like powdered eggs, and drank the bitter coffee of the realm. And then I set out to look at Cromer in a decent light. I talked with a lot of East Anglians that day. Most of the talk was small, none of it important. It was the talk of the little people of a small town in a big war. It was homely, full of such things as the quiet satisfaction of the salvage worker who helped win a prize.
We here in Cromer won the East Anglia salvage contest. Got first prize of £100.
That's swell. What'd you do with the money?
£50 to the hospital, £25 to the District Nursing Association, and £25 to the Red Cross.
And the bombed-out landlady on Overstrand Road who told me...
Hey, it's hard. Very hard. Most of the room and houses have been ruined.
Bombs, you mean?
No, I mean ruined. As businesses. We never had a season before the war when we couldn't rent rooms. But with evacuation and no bathing in the summertime, some of us had to sell our furniture and move out.
And the fisherman whose trawler had been attacked by a Faka wolf and whose son had been killed?
Do you know what the town went and done? We adopted a minesweeper.
Adopted one? How do you mean?
Well, we sent it a wireless set and a whole shelf of books and £19 in cash.
What's the name of the minesweeper?
HMS Cromer.
Then there was George Lusby, foreman of Cromer's rescue squad. Said he had memorized the location of 300 shelters around town so he could find any one of them in the dark.
It's very difficult in the dark to distinguish between bodies and rubble because the bodies are so covered with dust.
You ever feel squeamish? Blood and stuff?
Oh, you don't mind it when you're working in an emergency. It's when you get quiet moments later that reaction might set in. Worst things are the disappointments.
What do you mean?
Well, it's most disappointing to dig and dig and dig and then find the man you're digging for is dead.
I went down to the post office. It was opposite the Church of St. Peter and St. Paul, and you could hear the organist practicing across the way. The postmaster explained that the stained glass windows of the church had been blown out when the bomb struck, so there was nothing to stop the sound from crossing the street and filling the post office.
We work on an odor of sanctity, you see.
I asked him whether the post office had been much affected by the war.
Oh, there's no comparison between the amount of mail we handle now and what we used to handle before the war.
Lost any personnel?
A postman was injured when the office was hit. But there was no interruption in the service, though. The bomb struck around midnight, but in spite of the damage, we managed to get the 9 o'clock mail out in time the following morning.
How on earth did you do it?
Well, we moved everything we needed into the lecture hall of the Band of Hope. That's a teetotaler organization here in Cromer.
Mm-hmm.
Had to dig out our equipment and move it through the rain.
What's that? German plane attacking?
No, that's just a Spitfire. Gunnery practice. See, you can see the plane ahead of him, towing the target sleeve.
I watched this for a while to the accompaniment of Ye Holy Angels Bright from the church organ, and then I left to keep an appointment. The last visit I made in Cromer was to the home of its most famous son, Henry C. Blogg. He'd been described to me as the all-time Superman of lifeboat service. Saved 626 lives. Medals from George V and George VI. I went to see him where he lived in a small house near the waterfront. He was in his 70s, but still husky. His handshake was firm, his eyes were sharp. I asked him a foolish question, how it felt to be awarded so many medals.
You have to pack up and go to London to get the medals. They don't let you escape.
Where do you keep your medals, Mr. Blogg? I don't see them here anywhere.
My old lady's got them.
He looked around quickly to see whether his wife had heard that.
Yes, London always seems a devil of a long way to go for a medal.
I coaxed him into telling me of some of his exploits. He told about the night when 8 ships were wrecked off Cromer. About another time when he deliberately ran his lifeboat onto the deck of a wrecked freighter in the midst of a gale, because that was the only way he could rescue 16 men aboard. Once he mentioned lazy winds. I asked him what a lazy wind was.
A lazy wind is a wind that's too lazy to go around you, so it goes through you.
Reluctantly, he showed me his medals.
2 kings gave me these gold ones.
Imagine that.
Life-saving is only a sideline with me. I make my living fishing, renting beach huts.
Uh-huh.
I don't believe lifeboat crews should get paid.
Why?
Wouldn't get as good results.
He was very firm about that. I figured he should know. After all, any man who saves 626 lives has earned the right to refuse to accept money for it. I said goodbye to Mr. Blogg and headed back to the Red Lion. I drifted into the lounge, sat by the bay window, looking out on the sea. There was a copy of the Norwich News on the table, with headlines of a raid elsewhere in East Anglia that morning. The man I had met earlier in the pub came in, looked around, sat down beside me, and asked me a leading question.
Well, do you like what you've seen of Cromer?
Yes, thank you very much.
But many things have changed here, you know.
That's so?
But the changes are nothing compared to what we'll see when the war's over.
You think so?
Got to be changes. We've got to do better about getting along with other people. No reason all kinds of people can't be friends.
That's right.
We all of us had a lot of silly ideas before the war. Wouldn't you agree? Don't you think there'll be changes? Everywhere. Right here.
Here in Cromer?
Sure, why not? What's the matter with Cromer?
Oh, nothing. Nothing's the matter.
All I can say is that if there aren't changes in Cromer after the war, I mean good things, better things for everybody, then we've just been wasting our time, that's all. If not, I say Cromer's just wasting its time.
At that point, his eye happened to fall on the Norwich News, and he picked it up, got lost on page one. I returned to the big window. It was getting dark in the east. The European night, with all its menace and secret movement, was even now over the country of the enemy. About a half mile offshore, some cargo ships rode at anchor. And my thoughts rode at anchor, too. I thought of the faces I had seen that day. The faces of our allies in the little town of Cromer. And I thought of what they'd said to me.
Cromer won the East Anglia salvage contest.
Oh, you don't mind working in an emergency? It's when you get quiet moments later that reaction might set in.
Two kings gave me those gold medals.
Better things for everybody. If not, Cromer's just wasting its time.
I drew a bead on the first star of the evening, which had just risen on the horizon. And gazing at it, I wondered about the biggest salvage contest of all time, and who would win it. I wondered whether, when the world gets quiet moments later, a new brand of reaction might set in. Whether anything was being planned ahead to avoid that. I wondered whether maybe, in some golden day, humanity itself might raid a medal from the greatest of the kings.
Sorry, I've got to do the blackout. Excuse me.
I don't know what it was that made me ask the maid, but I turned to her in sort of a trance and said, "You don't think Cromer's wasting its time, do you?" She looked at me, greatly puzzled, moved away, saying,
"No, I don't suppose it is."
And I've thought about it since. And the more I think of it, the more I'm sure that Cromer's not wasting its time.
Have been listening to Cromer, written, produced, and directed by Norman Corwin for CBS as the 10th of a series. Joseph Julian narrated, and Nicholas Joy was the man in the pub. Others in the cast were Minerva Pius, Bertram Tanswell, Nora Howard, J. Malcolm Dunn, John Moore, Frank Lovejoy, Kermit Murdoch, Burford Hamden, and Roland Bottomley. Music was composed and conducted by Lynn Murray. The script of Cromer appears in the book More by Corwin. Next week at this time, Columbia presents the second of Corwin's trilogy of cities, New York, A Tapestry for Radio, with Martin Gable in the leading role and music by Lynn Murray and Frederick Steiner. Harry Marble speaking. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.